Okay, tonight will be about 5 minutes sooner, but with Brother Stevens here, we're going to kind of break at the first bell and then go in and have a few extra minutes where he can sing another song or two with us. So just be aware of that, and we'll ask that we kind of move in fairly quickly and get started, give him as much time as we can. All right, I don't have any new handouts tonight, but we're in this section, really, between this week and next week. Of course, there's quite a bit said about the tabernacle and the priesthood. And what I want to do is, I won't get too technical tonight about the tabernacle, but I do want to say a few things about it and the purposes that are there. You might recall that in reading, Moses would often go, he would set up a location really kind of outside the camp, and set up what he called a tent of meeting. And that's really what the tabernacle is. It's a tent of meeting, but the point is that Moses already had that kind of thing going, but God now is going to tell him to do this in a very specified kind of way. And how particular is God about the instructions here?
Very specific.
It's very specific. He really leaves very little to their choice. You know, when we talk about authority, we make the point that the more specified you get, the fewer choices you're going to have. And that's just the nature of communication. Well, God is very specific and leaves very little to their choices. So he spells it out and tells Moses, of course, that see that you make all things according to what? According to the pattern which was shown you on the mountain. That's kind of the expression that you'll find. And the New Testament in Hebrews 8 references that very point. That God had a pattern that he expected the people to follow. And, you know, he doesn't explain himself that. He doesn't say, I selected this pattern because A, B, C, and D. He just expects them to obey the covenant. And maybe sometimes God gives instructions like that because he's checking to see, will they really obey or not. But whatever God's reasons are, they needed to listen. So the idea of a tabernacle, of course, really is just an idea of a tent. And so this concept of an earthly dwelling place is seen. And what is the emphasis of the tabernacle?
Holiness.
Well, holiness is certainly part of it, but it's really about the presence of God. It's about the presence of God. So God was among them. God was dwelling among them would be the notion here. You know, when you stop and think about it, the issues that surround this idea of a dwelling place of God really begin back in Genesis 1 and 2 when God sets up the Garden of Eden and, you know, puts Adam and Eve in it, and then he's dwelling there with them in and among them. And so you have a, you know, and there doesn't really appear to be in the garden, there doesn't really appear to be any special meeting place, at least nothing that's said that we can see. But what happened at the fall? When Adam and Eve sin, there's alienation, right? There's a loss of fellowship that takes place at that point. So you could no longer readily be in the presence of God. And I want you to see this as a biblical theme, really, from beginning to end. So you can't just appear in the presence of God anymore because sin has made this wall between you. And so what God did was he developed special meeting places, basically. Either God would meet them somewhere or whatever. But I think this is what developed with the idea of the tent of meeting, where God would have a special meeting place with Moses in this particular case. During the patriarchal period, Abraham and so forth, what would they build often? We don't read about tents of meeting, but they would build altars. And what was the purpose of those altars? The heads of the families could conduct worship. They could offer whatever sacrifices or whatever. And so it's kind of the idea of a designated place where you could meet with God, as it were. And now what has changed, of course, is that the nation promise has essentially come about. And God now has a special people that he wants to have this covenant relationship with. And so now he says, for the nation, I want you to construct this special tent of meeting, this special tabernacle, and my presence will be seen in that. Now, the form of this was basically, it's a tent. It's a form of a nomad tent. Why would it need to be this way? Yeah, they're in the wilderness, so they got to move it from time to time. When God said to move, they would have to move. And of course, as we see in the readings, who was it that had the charge of the tabernacle, taking it up and taking care of it and all of that? Who had to do that? The Levites did. So the Levites had a special service in and around the tabernacle, and that was separate from what the priests would often do. Because the priests would go into the tabernacle. Not all Levites could do that. Remember that just because you were a Levite doesn't mean you were a priest. The priests especially came from whose family?
Aaron.
Had to be from Aaron's family. So, Moses was a Levite, but he wasn't a priest. Now, Aaron was the high priest. Just think in terms of this idea of a designated place where you would meet with God. And in that sense, then, it was considered to be holy ground. You think about when Moses met with God at the burning bush, and what did God tell Moses? Take off your sandals. This is holy ground. Well, why? It's not so much because this piece of dirt is what's holy. Why is it holy? It's God's presence. That's the point. It's the presence of God. And so that concept now needs to really be driven home to the children of Israel. And this is why the presence of God, the priesthood, and holiness all go hand in hand. God was teaching them lessons about the need to be holy, or as we might think of developing a culture of holiness in all the actions that they were engaging in and doing. So there are four things about this that I just want to kind of mention. And again, I'm not going to go into great detail here, but just to kind of introduce this point about the tabernacle. First is the location, that when the tabernacle would be set up, where would it be? Right in the center of camp. And God spells out where all the tribes are going to be. So basically you'd have, tabernacle set up, and then you'd have, the various tribes, north, south, east, and west, and all around. And then who's going to be right around it? The Levites are going to be right around it. So again, they're kind of the protectors of the tabernacle. Now, and this is important because, in the ancient Near East, often what would happen is that you have a king, and when they would go out to battle or go out, on some kind of crusade or whatever, where would the king be placed? His tent would always be placed right in the middle. And so this was a way of essentially affirming that concept in their minds that God is your king. He is the one that is in control and in charge. God would, when they would take it down and Israel would move, what would lead the way? Well, the priests with the Ark of the Covenant. Why? Well, because what is the Ark of the Covenant? It's like God's throne, the mercy seat and so forth. This is where God sits, essentially, and rules. So that's the concept that I think is being driven home by this. I also want to mention kind of the design of it. And again, I won't go into detail about this other than to say, so you got different parts, of course, courtyard, holy place, most holy place, and all of that. And I want to kind of combine this with the idea of accessibility. I never can spell on the board. And the idea of accessibility. What I want you to think about is the idea of what some have called circles of holiness. So if you're looking at the camp, let's say that, you know, on the big scale, you got the camp. What's outside the camp? Well, you're going to have, first of all, this is where the Gentiles would be. They did have quite a few Gentiles who followed. So you'd have Gentiles outside the camp. This is where they would send, you know, the sick or the people with leprosy or whatever. You had the unclean out here, you know, things of that nature. So this is where, you know, kind of the outside of the circle. But the further you go in, and this is part of the design, is how accessible God becomes now. Because the further you get in, you know, here you're inside the camp, but you're, you know, if you're in one of these tribes, you still don't have a right just to go in, right? You still have kind of an arm's length to keep. You get in here, you got the Levites, you're closer. They have special tasks associated with this. And of course, as you get inside, you got the holy place and the most holy place right here. The further you get in, what happens? The more holy it becomes, basically. So it's kind of a gradation, you know, circles of holiness, that the further, closer in you get, you know, the more holy it becomes. And they had to really pay attention to that. And the other thing about that would be the materials that it was made of. And all I want to say about that is that there's a correlation. Again, without going into detail here, the correlation that the materials that are being used, the closer in that you get, what happens? The value of those materials goes up. So, you know, on the outside, you got sea cow hides. It's, you know, water repellent. It's functional and all of that. But by the time you get into the Ark of the Covenant, what do you have? Everything is gold overlaid and all of that. So again, it just kind of all. My point is that all of these issues are reminders to the people. You know, everything that you're looking at, everything that you're doing, is reminding you of God and the holiness concepts and all of that. And so, just you know, think about how that really represents God among them and how He's taking care of this. And of course, by the time you get to the end of Exodus, which we're not there yet, but I do want you to, you know, as you're reading through to the end of this week, pay attention to the fact that by kind of the last thing that you see in Exodus has to do with the idea of God's glory. And, you know, this is something that is really emphasized by the dwelling of God, the presence of God. So God's glory becomes a huge issue. Now, I would also just point out, as you look ahead, of course, how does the idea of God's dwelling play into the Christian's relationship? Because, you know, this was not an end in itself. Of course, when they get into the land, what becomes the permanent structure of this? That's the temple. And Solomon, of course, is going to be the one who builds the temple. But even then, that's going to get destroyed down the road. By the time Jesus comes, what happens? The concept of the temple is pulled out once again. And in John 1 and verse 14, the Word became flesh and dwelled among us. And the word dwelled is the word tented or tabernacled. He tabernacled among us. Well, that's a purposeful connection. Back to this idea of the tabernacle. Because what do you have in Jesus? You have the presence of God among us. He is the tabernacle of God now. He is the most holy place, as it were. He is the king. See, all of these concepts, you know, he's the high priest, all these concepts come into play with Jesus. And not only that, but Christians themselves are then later called what? Christians are called the temple of God. 1 Corinthians 3, for example. So the church is God's temple. And that goes right along with what Jesus said, you know, I will build my church. He's going to build his temple. This is what was promised back in David's time in 2 Samuel chapter 7. He'd have a son who would build him build his house, build his temple. Well, Solomon did that, but that wasn't the end. See, all of these things, it's like stepping stones to the final piece of the puzzle, who is Jesus. And so you have the presence of God in and among his people. We are built up as a dwelling place of God in the Spirit, according to Ephesians 2nd chapter. So Christians become the temple of God. God's presence is in them and among them and so forth. And of course, the ultimate dwelling of God, you know, as you kind of carry that forward, is where? Well, with God, you know, in eternity. God's dwelling place, heaven, you know, however we want to think about that. It's the fact that you're in the presence of God eternally. Right? That's the point. So the concept of God's dwelling, the loss of that presence because of sin, the bringing back of that presence due to sacrifice, Jesus being the ultimate sacrifice and high priest, putting us back into a relationship and covenant fellowship with God, which allows us to enter into the most holy place because now, you know, he has opened up that new and living way. This is the theme of Scripture. Right? So the tabernacle is a very important piece of the puzzle. So more will be said about that. I also want to say a few things about the priesthood. And again, just kind of some basic ideas to get us thinking in this direction. Because as you're reading through these chapters, that's what you're getting. You're getting the priesthood, you're getting the tabernacle. What is the function, the basic function of a priest? What's his purpose? Okay, mediator. Yeah, getting it. Basically, what you have is the idea of a person who represents the people of God to God in order to offer sacrifice. Okay, represent the people to God. Think of it in those terms. And what's interesting, of course, is later. Well, here, if you have the priest who represents the people to God, later on, what is the king going to do? He's going to represent God to the people. Okay, so when you put those two things together, what do you have?
Christ.
You have Christ, you have the perfect mediator between God and man. Why? Because he's man and he's God. He's the king, he's the high priest. He can represent the people to God, he can represent God to the people perfectly. No other priest could do it like he could. All right? So later on, when we get to the kingship, that's part of the important, you know, part of that. That's in the future a little bit, but I want you to think of, you know, kind of be thinking in that direction. So the priest is going to represent God. Now, prior to the official priesthood, Levites, were there other priests?
Yes.
Yeah. Who have we already met?
Melchizedek.
Jethro, Melchizedek. And in fact, essentially, what did the heads of the households do? They functionally as priests for the people. Because, you know, the heads of the family, someone like Abraham, you build an altar. You're, you know, think about Job. We'll come to him later. He's doing the same thing. He's you know, worshiping God, you know, basically taking care of the family and offering sacrifice and that kind of thing. He's functioning as a priest. And they don't call him that, but that's the function, the basic idea. So God had basically three different levels of service. We mentioned the tribe of Levi. The tribe of Levi had basically the service of the temple, the work of the temple. And we'll see more specifics about that later. And then from the tribe of Levi, you had the priesthood that came from the family of Aaron. And of course, we're going to see a little bit later, too, how that becomes a point of contention for some people. Who exactly, you know, it's kind of like when in Korah's rebellion later on, you know, who told you you could be the priest? You know, we could be priests. You know, well, they're from the tribe of Levi too. Well, so it's a point of contention, and God, in a couple of different ways, reaffirms the Aaronic priesthood. That's Aaronic, not ironic. So he reaffirms the Aaronic priesthood, you know, the budding rod and number 17 and so forth. So he takes care of all that. But and then, of course, Aaron himself. So you have the family of Aaron who are the priests, and you have Aaron himself who's the first high priest. And the high priest is specifically chosen by God. And later, of course, other men will serve in that capacity after Aaron's gone. But typically, it's a divinely chosen kind of a situation there.
And the rest of the life, the Levites still had a special job.
Yes. That's what we said. The Levites, they had the work of the temple.
And teaching once they got into the land.
Teaching, the law. You know, we recognize, of course, that when they come into the land, when the land gets divvied up by tribe, instead of getting chunks of land, what do the Levites get? They get cities. And there's, you know, like 46 of them, and they're spread throughout all the land. So part of the reason for that is what? Well, if they're functionally teaching the law and so forth, then the idea would be if you're spread throughout the territories in all the tribes, then everybody's getting it. And of course, later on, when the prophets come along, they really show that one of the things that the priests and the Levites failed to do was they failed to do their teaching. And so, if they don't teach, it wouldn't work. They got to be out there teaching. All right. So now the other thing is that you read about in these chapters is that the priests receive a special wardrobe. I was just thinking about this as I was reading. Look at all of the different tasks that are assigned, the different jobs that people had. You know, from people who did the sewing to the woodworkers. You know, you had all kinds of jobs that are going into the building of the tabernacle and the priesthood wardrobe and all of these different functions. And God is giving skill and wisdom to these people so that it turns out exactly the way he would want it to. But again, what's the point of the clothing? Yeah, again, represents holiness, and it would kind of set them apart, and that's one of the things that I think about too, because later on when we think about the sacrifices, if the priest, what color was their clothing?
White.
Be white. And what are they doing? They're getting blood all over themselves. And when the high priest once a year on the Day of Atonement goes into the most holy place, what's he doing?
Sprinkling
the blood on the mercy seat. And I don't recall reading where they clean that up. You can imagine after years of this. I mean, it's just a reminder of the ugliness of sin. You know, that's part of the point of this. Okay. And of course, in the New Testament, Christ is going to be the ultimate priest. Now, I do want to point out, you know, going back to Exodus 19 for just a second, there is a sense in which the entire nation served as a priesthood. It's kind of interesting. Exodus chapter 19 and verse 6, "You shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation." So, in what sense is the entire nation a priesthood?
They're God's chosen people.
Well, they're God's chosen people. They're set apart from the rest of the nations. They're all tasked with praising God, right? And there's a sense, and you know, Isaiah talks about them being a light to the nations and so forth. So, you know, how are the nations going to come properly into contact with Yahweh? Well, it's going to be through them. So in that sense, the nation represents the people to God that way. And that would include even the Gentiles. And of course, in the New Testament, who are we? We are a kingdom of priests. Same idea, same concept. And we are the bridge, as it were, to the world, to bring them to God. So that's the idea. So the basic functions of the priesthood, they would offer sacrifices, they would conduct worship, the tabernacle, they would teach the law to the people, and in some cases would judge matters of holiness and cleanliness, like in cases of leprosy. Leviticus 13:14 talks about that. So they were busy. They were functionally very active if they were doing their job right. I won't talk about the sacrificial system right now, but I do want to come back before we're done this evening. Let's come back to Exodus 32. Now, have the people already received the Ten Commandments? Yeah, I mean, even before Moses initially went up on the mountain, they had already heard that they're not to make graven images. And I mean, the instructions were already basically there. So they knew better. So here's the question. And you know, we're familiar with the golden calf scenario here in Exodus 32. Why did they do it? What's their problem? Okay. Now look, and I try to look at this from the standpoint of how would they have been thinking, you know? Now you would think that, you know, they have seen these mighty acts of God, they've been impressed with this. It's not that they're becoming unbelievers, okay? They're not. But Moses went up on the mountain, and what do they begin to think? He's not coming back. It's not like 10 minutes after he went up there they were doing this. I mean, they waited. They were thinking, I mean, you know, he's up there 40 days. He's not coming back. Well, what would you think? It's not like Moses could text Aaron and say, "Hey, I'm up here still, don't worry about me." Right? What would you think? You go up into this mountain that has been violently quaking and the smoke and everything going on there, and you disappear into that, you're not coming back. I think it's kind of interesting. It's almost like a resurrection of Moses when he comes back out, you know. So they go to Aaron. Well, Aaron is the natural leader, right, in this case, because he's been with Moses all this time and he's the one they know and recognize. And what do they ask?
Take their gold domes so they can make a calf.
Yeah, we want to make a gold. Okay, why a calf? I mean, look, I realize from our perspective, you know, you'd think, well, this is not really very flattering. Let's make a cow, you know, for a god. But just remember where they came from. Where have they been? In Egypt. What kinds of gods do you see in Egypt?
This, yeah, exactly. I would suspect very strongly that the golden calf they made probably somewhat resembles the kind of golden, the kind of calf you would see in Egypt as among the gods. And in their minds, it's just the idea that, that this is the representation of God. Now, the thing about that is they're not making this and saying we're worshiping an Egyptian god. What do they call this calf? They believe this is a representation of Yahweh. Yeah. But remember that, you know, God specifically said not to make any graven images of me. It wasn't just a prohibition against, you know, just images. I mean, it was don't make it of me. So they are directly in violation of what God specified about making graven images here. Now, yeah, they weren't to make images of other gods either, but you get the idea. So they think it's a representation of God. Why, though, again, kind of going back to the Ten Commandments, why, though, is God so adamant about this? Why not make any graven images of God? You simply don't contain God within the imagination of a man, you know, like that. You just can't. And it's an insult to him. And of course, it is in direct contrast to what you see going on in the pagan world, because that's what they did. All the time, that's what they did. You know, idol after idol. You know. And of course, this is going to be mirrored a little bit later. You recall, if you fast forward a little bit, when the kingdom later divides, remember which king makes golden calves and puts them at Dan and Bethel? Jeroboam, the first king of the north. So that's going to be mirrored a little bit later. Again, you would think, if he knew his history, this is a big no-no. You don't touch this. You don't do this. But this event... All right, so Aaron goes along with it. And you have to wonder, you know, Aaron, what is your problem? I mean, if anybody... He's the high priest. He knows, you know, better. So why does he give in? Probably the easy way to do it, you know. He doesn't want to buck against the people. He wants to be liked, whatever.
He might have thought he wasn't coming back.
And he yeah. So there's confusion, you know, without Moses, what are we going to do? And we've already said, you know, for God not to talk directly to us, so, you know, what are we going to do? So why don't we go ahead and violate what God said not to do? I mean, you know. That's what they end up doing. All right, so Aaron says, all right, everybody, you know, we're going to melt down your earrings and different, you know, gold pieces and all this kind of stuff, and we're going to make this golden calf. And about that time, what happens? All right, now God told Moses, didn't he? And how is God feeling about this scenario here? You know, Moses, I'm going to kill those people. Because look at what they're doing. Now, Moses, of course, comes down the mountain, and now he's going to demonstrate his anger. And what is the really the visible thing that he does that really is very symbolic? Breaks the tablets. And of course, I don't see this as just he just lost his temper and he threw them down. I think it's a deliberate point. You have broken the covenant.